Meanwhile, we have other groups such as the Libertines, who were not exactly, you know, sexual libertines, although the Marquis de Sade, but were another kind of antinomian, quasi-Protestant heresy. We have the Family of Love, who were kind of a secret society who practiced mysticism and were very non-authoritarian. They moved from Germany into Holland, eventually into England. So that's the link between your 16th century ultra-Protestants, so to speak, and the 17th century sect of the Civil War era is the Family of Love. It's a very key and interesting group on which very little work has been done. We have the Rosicrucians, who appeared around 1620, 1617, 1620, with their idea of radical tolerance, as I call it. They were basically saw themselves again as a force that would be neither Roman nor Lutheran nor Calvinist, but something else, something more liberatory, based in this case on Hermeticism and occultism, alchemy, and the idea of alchemical healing, which they had inherited from Paracelsus. And this, they published anonymous manifestos, which caused a big stir in Europe, and pretty much nothing came of it, because immediately the whole project failed as far as its politics were concerned with the beginning of the 30 Years' War, which is one of the most disgusting wars in the whole disgusting history of war, as it was in fact a religious war. Not even in pretense, but in fact a religious war with Protestants and Catholics slaughtering each other for 30 years all over Northern Europe. And this put an end to the Rosicrucian dream. You can read about this in Francis Yates, F-R-A-N-C-E-S, Yates, Y-A-T-E-S, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment. A brilliant book, very brilliant book. Then we have the German mystics, which I mentioned briefly earlier, Meister Eckhart, Tauler, Suso. Later on we have Jakob Boehme, the Hermetic Pietists. We have Jane Ledd, one of the interesting women leaders of this movement in London. These people are not at all political, generally, unless they're forced to be. They're really quietist, separatist, mystic types. But just because of that, they get in trouble with the church. Eckhart was almost excommunicated. If he hadn't died before the church got around to trying him, he probably would have been excommunicated. Finally, we get to the English Revolution. Here I would recommend very strongly Christopher Hill, The World Turned Upside Down, sort of standard work on the wacky Protestant sects of the Civil War, and to a certain extent J.P. Thompson, another British Marxist historian. I like them both very, very much. Groups such as the Diggers, the Ranchers, the Levellers, the Seekers, the Fifth Monarchy Men, the Muggletonians, early Quakers, Antinomians, the Diggers were agrarian radicals. Gerard Winstanley was their leader, wrote beautiful books. They tried to have a commune outside London. They were crushed by Cromwell. Not by the king, but by Cromwell. It was part of Cromwell's, the inevitable counter-revolution, you might say, is that the really interesting, really radical Protestant sects in the 1640s were looked on as a danger to the Commonwealth under Cromwell. So that it was Cromwell who bored hot irons through the tongues of early Quakers like John Naylor. It was Cromwell who had Diggers and Ranters executed or put in the stocks or exiled to Jamaica or Barbados. Cromwell was, in this sense, a Stalin, if you like. That's a vast oversimplification, and I apologize for it, but it's true. There was a counter-revolutionary aspect to the Civil War. Once the heretics got in power, they weren't heretics anymore. They were the orthodoxy. And so anyone who became heretical in relation to them was in even worse trouble than they had been before, because nobody knew the old, you know, Archbishop Laud and these kind of people didn't even know the difference between a ranter and a leveler. But the Cromwellians did. They were their, you know, they were their comrades in the army. They knew exactly who they were, and they knew exactly what they were saying, which was down with government. So, especially the Diggers, Ranters, and Levellers. The Seekers, for example, Roger Williams was a Seeker, the founder of Rhode Island. These were people who took a wait-and-see attitude, literally. They were waiting on the Lord. They knew there was something wrong with all the existing churches, but they didn't know what. So they were seeking. but they organized as such to a certain extent. The Fifth Monarchy men and the Muggletonians were kind of late manifestation of this millenarian madness that Christopher Hill describes so beautifully in his book, the idea of the imminence of the end of the world, which at the same time is the return of the Golden Age. The end of the millennium is also the return of the Golden Age. This myth comes from classical antiquity and is completely englobed into the whole of Christian European culture as a sub-theme which appears over and over and over again, and probably most recently in the communist movement, which very definitely had millenarian aspects. It's talking about the coming of perfection on the level of physical reality. So this is a fine old tradition, if you like, whether you like it or not. It's very much part of our heritage and needs to be thought about. By the way, William Blake's mother was a Muggletonian, as discovered by E.P. Thompson in his last fascinating little book on Blake, which I recommend. So Blake was not only in interested in Swedenborg and the other crazy mysticisms of his day, he actually belonged to this 1640 tradition by virtue of his own family connections. From there we kind of move on. All right, we move on to more or less late 16th, early 17th century, what I call left-wing Freemasonry. In 1717, you get the founding of the Grand Lodge of Freemasonry in London at the Apple Tree Tavern, about three doors down from Blake's house, by the way, where later on the Order of Druids was also refounded. Actually, later on that year, the Order of Druids was refounded. The Order of Druids acquired quite a lot of free thinkers and radicals, including Blake, probably, Paine, who wrote an essay, if you don't believe me, it's in his collected works, called Druid Freemasonry, in which he praises it to the skies, and quite a lot of the freethinkers at the time. It's a very complex and interesting subject, Druidism in the 18th century, I've got an essay in my forthcoming, God willing, book on history of New York State, because the Druids had a big impact here in Newburgh, New York, up the river, up the Hudson River. There was and in New York City. And all of them were totally freaky radical Freemasons. I mean, you know, way to the left of Jefferson. Yeah? They were Paineites, basically. They were followers of Paine, who suggested a temple of reason, a philanthropic temple of a religion of reason. Okay? An idea which seems completely paradoxical to us now, looking back with our perfect hindsight, looking back on the Enlightenment. How could there be a religion of reason? Well, Thomas Paine suggested it. They had one here in New York, they had one in Philadelphia, and they had one in Newburgh, New York, which I've tried to write about. John Tolland, the 17th century philosopher, Mason, rogue Mason to be sure, and author of one of the very first books on Druidism, was a key figure here, as was Blake himself, of course. As I've said here, William Blake, sine qua non, without which nothing. You know, Blake is really, in my view, the linchpin of this whole list. Going on from there, we would come into Romanticism, especially the left wing of German and English Romanticism, which sort of collapsed as a result of the Terror and the Napoleonic takeover. It's very much like many elements of leftism collapsed in Europe and America when the crimes of Stalin became clear. Also, when the crimes of the French Revolution began to become clear, many of the people who had supported it vigorously, especially young romantics like Wordsworth and Coleridge, turned their backs on it. Some of them went so far as later on to become out-and-out reactionaries, I would say, certainly Coleridge. Much as I admire him, there's no doubt that he ended up very much on the right. Others never gave up, either because they died too early or killed themselves. In dismay, but there has always been a left wing of Romanticism, even amongst those who look back to the Middle Ages and are thought to be so reactionary. After all, that is a perfect description of William Morris, a socialist anarchist who looked back to the Middle Ages, the Christian Middle Ages, as his model for a perfect society. Read News from Nowhere by Morris, one of the most important British anarchist thinkers. We could mention here Thoreau and Emerson in particular, and my own favorite, Stephen Pearl Andrews, another New York eccentric anarchist who founded the commune Modern Times in Brentwood, Long Island. and was had a very distinct religious side to him. He founded his own church and was involved in spiritualism. He was one of the many, many people, radical people in the 19th century who were involved in seances with summoning up spirits of dead people. Again, something which seems so incomprehensible to us, unless we look at it from the point of view, as one American historian said, there is no new age. There never has been a new age, because there was always a new age before it. And in this case, we have the 1850s, which is certainly everything that came out in the 1950s and 70s was already there in potentia, and maybe even more fully realized in some fields in the 1840s and 50s. Fourierism, you had German communism and socialism coming in. You had Native American anarchism of the individualist Josiah Warren, Benjamin Tucker type. You had every kind of utopian idea from Cabot, from Icaria, John Humphrey Noyes, Oneida. Commune in upstate New York. Upstate New York was very active in this period. It was the California of the 19th century New Age, you might say. All right, I'm getting to the end here, so don't despair. I just wanted to go on to quickly mention, the religion of nature and the Native American influence, Thoreau, his fascination with Native American spirituality. Then moving on into very late 19th century, early 20th century Romanticism, if I can call it that. People like Gustav Landauer, the great anarchist philosopher who was murdered by the proto-Nazis after the fall of the Munich Soviet in 1919, and his friends Gershom Scholem and Walter Benjamin, two Jewish philosophers who were both anarchists. In fact, Benjamin was a Marxist, but also an anarchist. And once somebody asked him why he never joined the party, meaning the Communist Party. And he said, I guess it's because of my old anarchism. And Scholem, who was a great scholar of Kabbalistic heresy, was an active Jewish anarchist in the line of Martin Buber. Buber would never made the leap to anarchism quite himself. He was very sympathetic towards it. So we had that whole German romantic Jewish leftism to consider. Also, again, I find it very much a lost area of discourse, because it isn't supposed to exist in the view of a lot of Orthodox historians. Then going on from there, Surrealism. We know that the Surrealists were fascinated with Hermeticism and with Oriental religion, with African religion, everything except Christianity. They would always spit on a Catholic priest, but they would, they had great interest in African fetish masks, for example, or in Giordano Bruno and the Hermeticists. Onto the side of them, I would mention Roger Calois, Georges Bataille, and the Collège de Sociologie, a short-lived, killed off by the Second World War, group of intellectuals in Paris who were very open minds about everything. Some people, I guess, would say their minds were so open their brains fell out. But they did. There's a book now called The College of Sociology in English, which has translated about 30 or 40 of the most brilliant papers that were given there. And many of the themes that we've dealt with here would come out in their work. And then moving up to the 1960s, I think it gets to be pretty obvious now. You see where I'm going here. The return of shamanism, the rebirth of the archaic revival, as Terence McKenna called it, the spiraling around. Everyone always says, there's no turning back the clock. This is always an excuse, meaning shut up and put up with reality as I say it. This is what capitalists tell you. There's no turning back the clock. Well, it's true there's no turning back the clock, but sometimes things return on their own in this spiraling model of history. You reach that same axis again at a different time and in a different way. And in my experience, this is what the 60s comprised when we discovered psychedelics, blew our minds, new left politics combined with psychedelics, and a growing appreciation for tribal shamanistic cultures that were dying out, disappearing around the world, fascination with Oriental mysticism and Christian heresies and so forth, Even the Diggers reappeared in San Francisco in 1967 or 66. So I think you see what I'm aiming at there, the psychedelic cults. All this is perhaps important, or perhaps it isn't. If what I'm saying has any validity at all, I think it's very important. If what I'm saying is a load of horse shit, then the 60s was, you know, just silly. Point 11. The critique of civilization needs a strong science of its own. Post-Enlightenment science, with its dead matter, crypto-metaphysics, needs a revolution, a Kuhnian revolution, if you're familiar with Thomas Kuhn, the guy who invented the idea of the scientific paradigm. We need a restitution of meaning. We need a re-enchantment of the landscape, if you'll allow me to say so. We need not just a Sorellian myth, George Sorel, but a real myth. We need surrealist, surrationalist, surregionalist subversion, which requires potent, earth-centered spirituality, a Gaia hypothesis that's more than merely hypothetical, a spiritual experience of the earth as a living being. Ecstasy as enstasy, okay? Ecstasy means, actually, literally means outside, the standing outside, i.e. of the body. Enstasy would mean standing inside the body. So what I'm trying to do is conflate these two terms and say that that ecstasy is enstasy. It's not an escape from the physicality. It's a kind of ultimate bestowal of meaning on physicality. Here I would refer you to the Russian philosopher Bakhtin and his work on the idea of celebration, on the Dionysiac moment of intoxication on the social scale. What's the name of his great book again? Bakhtin's it's the book about Rabelais. Rabelais and his world. He takes off from the great French late medieval French writer Rabelais. Festival consciousness as magic. The way I've phrased it. In this context, Hermeticism might recommend itself because of its rectified Neoplatonic view of matter as spirit, the doctrine of earth as a living being. This was very clear in the Renaissance Hermeticists. Nicholas of Cusa, who was himself a bishop of the church, was the first one to express this in modern times. It's a kind of twisting around of Platonism. I mean, Platonism talks about emanations and about the shadows in the cave and all this kind of thing. The implication is that material reality is on a lesser level than spiritual reality. What Cusa and Bruno and Ficino and the other great Renaissance Hermeticists do is turn that idea somewhat on its head and give Earth a new centrality, a new dignity. It's in Pico della Mirandola's famous oration on the dignity of man, which many people see as the founding document of the modern world. I would say that if we're looking for a religion, you know, for a spiritual framework, or even just flavoring, you know, for our environmental ecological side of our struggle, we could scarcely do better than to revive some of these old Renaissance magi who have a complete metaphysics of the living earth. The dignity of matter itself, the centrality of material, the fact that matter and spirit are really one, you know, really are one, not just a matter of speaking, but literally are one. So I would say Hermeticism is not a religion, but a science of spirit and imagination. It's meant to be empirical, experiential, and experimental. Historically, it's closer to us than shamanism or the Oriental ways. It's culturally familiar, although, of course, it's also strange. It's always strange. It's compatible with Christian, Jewish, Islamic, and Hindu mysticism, probably also with Taoism and Buddhism, certainly with Rosicrucianism and Masonry, and with most of the great heresies. So, in fact, I'm very interested in radical Hermeticism now, and you might say that's that's one of the lines I intend to pursue myself out of this whole list of possibilities. Finally, I don't want to argue for anarchist spirituality or spiritual anarchism. On principle, I don't want to argue this way. I say, by their fruits shall ye know them, to quote that book. Research here means participation, a willingness to hallucinate and be swept away beyond the censor of enlightened reason, perhaps even into the demonic, psychonauts in psychic bathyspheres. Thank you. My colleague, Mr. Bob, is about to pass amongst you, and we beg you to go on supporting this ongoing madness with maybe $5 if you can afford it, less if you can't, more if you can.
This is the antithesis of the thesis, you see. This is the spirit, and this is the earth.
And this box has been around here since you began in 86, and it's the same. They can't rush at us. We'll pass it around.
This used to happen in church too.
We're going to pass it around on this side. Make sure that it gets around to the other side. And now we go to the question and answer back and forth.
Could you people in the back keep it down a little? Just spend money quietly, please. Comments.
I'm a famous mathematician and logician called Kurt Gödel.
Yes.
And he has a theory that there are statements in mathematics which are true but not provable.
Yes.
I think if they're false, like, you could find counterexamples. So it's not just a matter of what's true and false is the same as what's provable and unprovable. So that might feed into this gap between meaningful and meaningless. In some abstract way.
I think it probably does.
There are another ways beyond meaningful.
I haven't read Hofstadter, so I don't know whether he's onto that idea or not. But some people are onto that idea. Gödel.
Yeah, Hofstadter is now depressed after he wrote Gödel, Eschenbach. He seems to have gone downhill. But in Gödel, Eschenbach, he talks about that you need circular connections between different hierarchies of things to create meaning. A certain angle on
the
subject.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Your point is well taken. I have nothing to add to that. Yeah. Yes.
In recent decades, there's been a lot of interest in Gnosticism, like Elaine Pagel's Gnostic Gospels, the Philip K. Dick material, and other authors dealing with that. To what extent has this developed as a congregation or a spiritual practice? Like, are there any Christian churches that accept the Gospel of Thomas or some of this other material?
Yes.
And what's the main...
The question is there a modern-day equivalent of Gnostic dualism? Are there any Christian or other churches that have adopted some of these ideas? Reference was made to the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, who made marvelous use of Gnostic dualist ideas in his writing. Harold Bloom, the literary critic, wrote a really wacky but interesting novel about Gnostic dualism. It's been in the air a lot in the 20th century, especially since Hans Jonas, the great German scholar of Gnosticism, wrote his groundbreaking essay comparing Gnostic dualism with 19th century nihilism. It's true that Gnosticism is always on the outside. It's always socially rebellious, and therefore we can find, as social rebels, if that's the way we think of ourselves, we could find a lot to sympathize with in it. And yes, indeed, there are modern-day Gnostic churches. They're all very small, and most of them are in California. And if you want to know more about it, I can introduce you to someone who's actually here, who's a Gnostic bishop. And he could tell you more about that. Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit more about how Neoplatonism and Gnostic dualism has affected our view of the natural world? I mean,
yes.
I don't really associate them too much with the attitudes of the environmentalists, but I never really thought of that. So can you talk more?
Yeah. Well, if you only know, of course, classical Platonism, or for that matter, classical Neoplatonism, it might come as a surprise to you to hear me putting them on the side, even. Trying to put them a little bit on the side of the Greens and the pro-Earth party. But here's the point. First there was Platonism. Then Gnostic dualism came along, and the Neoplatonists had to argue with the dualists. And they had to say, wait, there are dualistic aspects to Platonism, but we're not dualists. Why not? Here's where we draw the line. Okay, the line is that the Earth is still good. It's not as good as the spirit, but it's not evil. So that beauty, physical beauty, for example, becomes the ladder towards philosophical realization.
So you have, all right, now you've got the Neoplatonists versus the Gnostic dualists on this point. And little by little, the Platonists are being pushed into a more and more anti-dualist position until finally when you get to very late Neoplatonism, i.e. the Renaissance, the process is over. Plato, to a certain extent, has been turned on his head. And even things in Plato, and I've seen this myself, texts in Plato, which are usually read as being anti-material, are used by the Renaissance philosophers to support their idea of the nobleness of the human of the human and of the physical earth. This is a very long story. I can't tell you any one book to read that's really explored this, but if you read around in Renaissance Hermeticism, you'll come across this strange paradox of a Neoplatonism that has becomes militantly anti-dualist. Yes. Yeah.
What is the Neo-dualism of Gnosticism? That's Zoroastrianism.
Does
it come from that tradition?
Zoroastrianism is the original dualist religion. It's probable that it had a great deal of influence on Gnosticism, but in a mediated way. It's mediated through exilic Judaism. When the Jews were sent into exile in Babylon, right, and then released by Cyrus and came back to Palestine, they brought a lot of Persian and Mesopotamian ideas with them, including, for example, angels, which never appear in the Bible until after the exilic period, including Satan, who's really a very shadowy figure until after the exilic period. So what you have is, I think, more of a mediated influence from Zoroastrianism on 1st century BC to 2nd century AD Gnosticism through later Rabbinic Judaism. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I heard a lot about Albert Cromwell being anti-Catholic. I didn't know he was. How come they kept it a secret till now? I never heard of him being anti-Protestant.
Well, have you heard that Stalin and Trotsky killed off all the anarchists in Russia? You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's exactly the same thing. You know,
right.
You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, but once the omelet is made, boy, no more eggs are to be broken.